Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending some time with me today. The American Museum of Natural History turns 150 this year. Today, the museum is one of the largest and most popular natural history museums in the world. It's famous for all the dinosaur bones and the life-size whale suspended in midair. For stargazers, there's the Rose Center for Earth and Space, completed in 2000, incorporating the older Hayden Planetarium, where I once had a birthday party. But the museum wasn't always the colossal major destination it is today. Back in the 1870s, the museum was just a single wing, and it sat alone on the edge of the newly constructed Central Park, which was actually kind of an issue where it was. Because all the people were downtown and it was a haul by horse and buggy. The museum's century and a half long story is told in author Colin Davies' new book, The American Museum of Natural History and How It Got That Way. Tracing the museum's history from when it was just an idea, weaving in classic New York figures like Teddy Roosevelt, Boss Tweed, Robert Moses, in detailing how much the institution has evolved over the years, the book brings the American Museum of Natural History to life, but luckily not in a night at the museum kind of way. Colin, welcome to the studio.
My pleasure. And following Jonathan Waters, really?
It's a good day. It's a good day. So I have to start with the dinosaur bones. Were the dinosaurs always a part of the museum? I mean, did paleontology even exist when it started?
It was just starting to exist. And in fact, my story weaves the story of the museum's dinosaur exhibits into the history of paleontology because it was a field that was maybe a few decades old, and the term dinosaur had been coined relatively recently. And there were two of the premier paleontologists at the time, Othniel Marsh and Cope, losing his name here for a moment, but who were pretty much ripping each other's guts out over sabotaging each other's finds and negatively reviewing each other's publications. And that burst into the news. And that's about when the museum decided to get into the dinosaur business. And they hired Henry Fairfield Osborne, who became the museum's president later, to start the paleontology department.
Our crackerjack producer just typed to me, it was Edward Cope.
Oh, thank you.
There you go. So when you're learning about the museum, as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking to myself, I'd love you to answer this question. How do you think learning about the museum's history and construction would enhance someone's visit to the museum now?
Well, this book is largely about the structure of the museum. That makes it a little different than some of the other books where they talk largely about the expeditions and personalities of the museum. But I was always fascinated, since I was visiting the museum frequently as a child and getting lost all the time, about this big, complicated 4-block by 4-block structure. So the book emphasizes that, so that when you know the history of the order of the buildings were built and the story behind that, I find it made a big difference in being able to know where I was in the space and to find my way around.
Let's talk about
I want to touch briefly back on the dinosaur topic, though. The museum, at the time they had their first dinosaur exhibit, only was the 77th Street side. Right now, there's two huge halls with two different categories of dinosaurs. But when it first opened, you know those little round corner parts of the building? Well, if you've seen pictures of... Anyway, maybe about the size of from here to that end of the building over here, they had the Tyrannosaurus Rex, the Apatosaurus, which was called the Brontosaurus at the time, two duck-billed dinosaurs, and an Allosaurus, all in that one tight space. And these are some of the dinosaurs that now are the cornerstones of the whole exhibit. They're in those islands that are in the center of those main halls. All were in that one tight little space.
That's amazing. Anybody who's got a little kid in New York City has spent some quality time in that part of the museum. One, because it's so interesting to little kids, and also it keeps them contained. I want to ask about the philosophy of some of the people who were really important in the creation of the museum. And Morris Jessup is one of the people I want to talk about.
Yes.
What do we need to know about him and his relationship to the museum?
They brought him in as because he was a businessman, and the museum had opened, and as you had mentioned, it was very remotely located at the time, and they had very disappointing attendance. So they figured, we'll bring in one of the trustees who's a businessman, and he'll help us like tighten our belt and maybe think about shrinking the goals and so forth. But after he dived in, he took the opposite approach and he went to expand. And that's what happened under his watch. So he had to get the trustees who were getting discouraged. He had to get them enthusiastic about more building. And he also helped launch the golden age of exploration at the museum, where they started collecting their own material rather than buying collections. So they were going all over the world, including for the expeditions for the dinosaurs. And he was instrumental in the Robert Perry expedition, which ultimately led to Robert Perry supposedly going to the North Pole. And I say supposedly because it's controversial. I don't have an opinion on that, but that is controversial. And bring back the largest meteorite that's in any museum. Yes, that was his major
contribution.
But the entire 77th Street part of the museum was built under his watch. And that was actually a lot of controversy around that. Not so much about the architecture or the fact that it would be built, but at the time, once he became the president, there was a 10-year battle with dozens and dozens of New York Times articles about it, all based on would the museum open on Sundays.
Right.
Because they were all very strict Sabbatarians, most of the trustees, and so were a lot of the donors. So even if they thought about opening on a Sunday, people who were donating millions of dollars might have dropped out. But on the other hand, that was the only day off for many of the people who would be interested in going to the museum, and all the progressive forces in the city were signing petition after petition, the labor people, the immigrant groups. So, there are several sections in the book about that, but that was ultimately they resolved it and they got the funding for the building. And Jessup ultimately regretted the whole thing and said that he was glad that they finally opened on Sundays. Although he was one of the people who were against it, one of the leaders against opening on Sundays at first.
My guest is Colin Davey. He's the author of the book, The American Museum of Natural History and How It Got That Way. When did it first open? Whose idea was it? And how did they pick the spot?
It first opened in actually the Arsenal building, which existed before Central Park. Albert Bickmore is the founder. He had worked in the Agassiz Museum, and he got the idea of starting a museum in New York, and he gathered the support of a lot of the wealthy New Yorkers, and they sent a petition to Andrew Green to have the project supported by the Central Park Commission. And if nothing, one of the things that this book should do, hopefully, is make the name Andrew Haswell Green known to New Yorkers. He's a character like Robert Moses that he was at least as influential a shaper of New York City as Robert Moses, and I had never heard of him. I gave a talk the other day, for a crowd of very educated New Yorkers who are interested in the museum, and I said, how many people here have heard of Robert Moses? And everyone's hands shoot up. How many people have heard of William Boss Tweed? Everyone's hands shoot up. How many people heard of Andrew Green? No one's hands shot up. So I figured, okay, I don't have to feel bad that I had never heard of him, because I considered myself a fairly knowledgeable New York history person. But he's the one. I'll give you a quick summary of his accomplishments. At this time, he was an early commissioner of Central Park, as important to Central Park as Vox and Olmsted, the landscape architects whose names are really associated with it. He was their boss, essentially. And he was considered a founder of the American Museum of Natural History, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the New York Public Library System, the Bronx Zoo, and he is the man who had the idea and promoted it for decades of uniting Manhattan, the boroughs, Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, and Staten Island, into Greater New York, which happened around 1898. So for that, the people who do know about him consider him to be the father of New York City. But the site that the museum is on across from Central Park is, it used to be called Manhattan Square. And the history behind Manhattan Square is kind of interesting. In 1811, New York didn't really exist below Greenwich Village. I mean, that it hadn't been developed below Greenwich Village. And if you know New York, it's all crazy down there. Like, the neighborhoods look like they were designed by Escher. But above it, it's all these neat grids, because the city commissioners realized one of these days we're going to expand, maybe in 100, 200 years, we're going to fill the whole island up. So let's plan to do it in an orderly fashion now. So in 1811, they released a proposed map with the neat little grids. And it didn't occur to anyone to have any major park space. Central Park wouldn't become an idea for decades. But Manhattan Square was on that map. So the site of the museum, Manhattan Square, actually preceded any notion of Central Park by decades. And then when the Central Park Commission started up and they held a competition and started working on Central Park in like the 1860s, they ultimately annexed Manhattan Square, and it's sort of a long story, but ultimately that did become the home of the museum.
What happened to the museum during the Great Depression? Because we have in the book, there's all this excitement about it. There's the building of it. There's all the politics of it. And then the Depression hits.
Well, the building had the shape that it has now, roughly, by 1935. And there was a lot of ambitions to expand it further. And that didn't end up happening till, like, now, like pretty much.
Yeah.
The shape the museum has now is pretty much the same shape that it had in 1935. In the late 90s, they put in the Rose Center, but that just replaced the Hayden Planetarium. So you could say there was new building at the museum at the time, but it still had the same basic footprint because the Rose Center replaced the planetarium. But Henry Fairfield Osborne's very forceful personality got a lot of that building to proceed, even though it was the Depression, but it kind of did come to a screeching point after that. But he got the Roosevelt Memorial put in, and the wing that has the whale in it, and he pushed for decades for the planetarium, although that didn't really happen till shortly after he left the presidency, but he sort of got the wheels set in motion for that.
My guest is Colin Davey. The name of his book is The American Museum of Natural History and how it got that way. And the second half of your book, you do talk about the Hayden Planetarium. It's part two of the book.
Yes. Originally, the original plan for the book was to be a book about the Hayden Planetarium.
Oh, interesting.
Because there was no book about the Hayden Planetarium. There were books about the museum. But in the process of learning the history of the planetarium, it was so integrally related to the history of the museum that it ended up growing to be a book about both, with the first half largely being about the museum and the second half being about the planetarium.
Why was there seen a need for the planetarium at the time?
Well, once again, it was Henry Fairfield Osborne who had the first idea that a natural history museum should include astronomy. And he started pushing for that like in 1908, as soon as he became president. And he saw that the evolution of the Earth and the evolution of the life on it had its original cause as being astronomical.
Yeah.
So he had proposed that the center, some people may have seen early pictures of the desired museum that has this huge skyscraper in the center. That was originally where he planned on having the astronomical exhibits be, because you know, you'd start in the center, and that was sort of the center of nature, so it would be in the center of the building.
There's new construction planned, correct? On the museum?
Yes, there is.
Are you, what do you think about it? What are you excited about it? Do you
I am excited
feelings?
About it. And well, this book was largely finished before that project was announced. So I had to write an epilogue to cover it. And the epilogue begins by saying, after the one draft of this book was done, it was announced that this new piece of construction would be done. And the final paragraph of the book is where I say that I update the audience about the most recent events, and I talk about how my editor said, just keep it short and get it in by tomorrow. And because as we're going to press, new developments were developing. But originally there was, from the very original design of the museum, there was going to be a wing all along Columbus Avenue. And the current plan is much contracted. I know there's controversy about it taking up park space, and I understand that, but compared to what the original design was in the 1870s, it's not all the way out to the Columbus Avenue like was originally planned. And it's spilling over into the park, maybe a quarter acre, but the vast majority of the new building will be on the footprint of some buildings that already exist that it's replacing.
The name of the book is The American Museum of Natural History and How It Got That Way. Its author is Colin Davey. Colin, thanks for coming by All of It.
Oh, my pleasure. It was fun.
Coming up after the break, a new documentary called Decade of Fire about the history of the Bronx in the 1970s. Stay with us.